Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 162, Interview with Michael Moorcock. This episode is brought to you by Majesty's Offspring, a new Singularity novel by A.J. Vega, and by Wolf Dawn, the new science fiction novel from Susan Cartwright.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
And welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell. Today we are joined by Michael Moorcock, who really, as I say when I introduce Michael, needs no introduction. He is a true legend in the fields of science fiction and fantasy, and one of the, according to, the London Times, I think, voted one of the 50 most important authors in the last 70 years in the UK, or I know. Great journalism here, huh? way to cite a story. The point is, he's a grand master and someone who has created some tremendous works and very memorable characters. He left the genre a different place than he found it. That's what I'm talking about. So he and I, we discuss his new Doctor Who novel, Coming of the Terrifiles, which actually, I believe, came out a year or two ago in hardcover, but was recently released in paperback here in the States. We also discuss his new collection of essays and Chris Robertson's Elric comic book, which is now available in paperback collections. At least Volume 1 is. Volume 2 is coming out in a few months. Now, before we get to the interview, I do have a few things to discuss with you folks, and I want to make sure you know about the two contests we have running right now. We've talked about one of these in the last episode, and the other one is a new one, first being introduced here. So, the one we already announced is a contest to win one of three autographed copies of Dark Victory by Michelle Lang, published by Tor. If you listen to episode 160 in her interview with Michelle, I really think you're going to want a copy of this book. It sounds amazing. And if you go back and check out episode 122, we talked with Michelle about Lady Lazarus, book one of this trilogy. And again, if you hear that interview, you will really want to read Lady Lazarus. To enter to win a copy of Dark Victory signed from the author, simply go onto Twitter and say, say this: I can't wait to read Dark Victory by at Michelle Lang. And yes, Michelle is spelled with one L, M-I-C-H-E-L-E-L-A-N-G. Also, make sure to include our handle at AISFP Podcast so we see the entry and we can count it. Entries are due by the end of the month, so you have a little bit less than 2 weeks to get these in and have a chance to win this. And yes, it's open worldwide. Michelle is going to pay for the shipping no matter where you are. It's a wonderful thing. Thank you, Michelle. We appreciate it. Oh, also remember, if you want a double entry, use the hashtag GollumsMakeGoodBouncers, and we'll count your entry twice. Okay, we have a second book we're going to run a contest for as well. This is a novel called Black Howl by Christina Henry, published by Ace. And here's the description. Something is wrong with the souls of Chicago's dead. Ghosts are walking the streets. And Agent of Death Madeline Black's exasperating boss wants her to figure out why. And while work is bad enough, Maddie has a plethora of personal problems too. Now that Gabriel has been assigned as her thrall, the relationship has hit an impasse. At least her sleazy ex-fiancé Nathaniel is out of the picture, or so she thinks. Walking Ghost, the Agent of Death. I mean, come on, what more can you ask for if you're an urban fantasy fan? To enter to win a copy of this novel, we're going to use the same rules as the Dark Victory contest. Simply jump on Twitter and tweet something about the book Black Howl. Something like, I can't wait to read Black Howl would work, for instance. And yes, don't forget to include our handle, AISFP Podcast, so that we can count your entry. Now, if you don't use Twitter, that's okay. You can post something on any social media platform. Just make sure to email us so that we know you did it. And you know what? If you don't have any social media platform at all, that's okay too. Just send us an email. Let us know which contest you want to be entered in, and we'll go ahead and give you an entry, give you a count to see if you can win the book. And if you forget the titles of any of these, simply come to the website, click on the show notes for this episode 162, or use the feature stories that you will find there with the rules for the contest. All right, one more bit of news, and this is exciting stuff. Been waiting to really talk about this, and I'm not giving you folks much advance notice, so I apologize. But we're very happy to be part of a new endeavor called Geek News Radio. And you can find the website at gnrnetwork.com. Now, what this is it's going to be a stream that runs 24 hours a day. And the event kicks off tomorrow, Saturday, February 18th. And on Saturday, there's actually going to be about 7 hours of live podcasts airing. Once the live portion is done for the day, then the syndication portion of the Geek News Radio will begin. So there's about 12, maybe 13 or 14 podcasts that are involved. We are one of them, along with SF Signal and several other geek-related, comics-related, literature-related podcasts. And they're going to stream continuously 24 hours a day, one after another. So it uses a technology called Stitcher. And you can learn all about this by coming to our website and clicking on the feature story about it. But basically, you sign up for Stitcher and you can download the app and put it on any mobile device. So anywhere you are, you can just hit the app and start playing the stream. It's like having a geek radio channel, that's why it's called Geek News Radio, in your pocket at all times. And if you really like a show that you hear there, you can go to their website, download their archives and all that good stuff. So it's very cool. We're happy to be a part of it. And we will be syndicated through that beginning tomorrow, Saturday the 18th. So please check it out. Send a note to the folks there that are organizing it. They've been working very hard on it. And we appreciate being included. It's a great thing. And to learn more about it, come to adventuresinscifipublishing.com. You'll see a big story there on the homepage. Can't miss it. And all the details you need are right there. All right, that is it for me. We'll be back next time with Brent and Moses, and we'll have feedback to talk about and a few news items we want to discuss as well. Until then, thank you for listening. Come enter the contest. We'd love to send you a book. And check out Geek News Radio. Michael Moorcock, back in a second. This episode is brought to you by the new science fiction novel Wolf Dawn by Susan Cartwright. Ashton Chayton was born with a powerful gift, a unique inhuman ability. Orphaned, raised by the Red Wolves of Open, captured and enslaved, he is now free and on the run. Unfortunately, everybody wants Ashton. Admiral Jones will torture him to get the secret of his power. Lady Linda feels he is the one, as named in Temple prophecy. The influential Lord Andros just wants him dead. Ashton only wants two things, revenge and the Lady Linda. If you had unique powers, wouldn't you use them to get what you want? Wolf Dawn is one of the first titles from Hotspur Publishing, and it is a title not afraid to explore material some would call controversial. That said, this is a fast-paced adventure novel that will keep you turning pages, and publisher David Bischoff says it is written in the vein of Dune and Ender's Game. Come to our website and click on the image for Wolf Dawn to learn more, or go to SusanCartwright.com to learn more about the author and the novel. Wolf Dawn, new science fiction by Susan Cartwright. It is cliche to say that somebody needs no introduction, but that is certainly true for our guest today. A grandmaster of science fiction and fantasy, Michael Moorcock has penned some of the most memorable and treasured stories and characters of the genre, and it's awesome to have him back on the show again. Thank you for joining us, Mike.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, as I was just telling you before we started recording, I have lots and lots of questions for you. But let's jump right in here. And first, I want to start off by talking about your new novel. I should ask you about this too. Doctor Who: The Coming of the Terrifiles. Now, it just came out in paperback, but this was published in hardcover last year, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was last year. Was it last year or the year before? I can't quite remember. It must have been last year. No, the paperback came out last year. So I think it came out... God, I'm sorry. I have no idea. I can't remember at all. The paperback just did come out recently, yeah. And of course, being, you know, having been published, it's old news for me. I'm already working on something else. So I'm kind of... If I'm slightly vague about it, you'll have to forgive me.
I know, that's the challenge of writing. Publishing is always a year or two behind, and then we ask you to remember as if you did it yesterday.
Yes, quite.
Well, certainly the book came to my attention just this past holiday season. It was a featured book at Barnes & Noble, and they had it, you know, faced out in the new release section. So I'm not sure when it was first released in the States, but they were certainly treating it like it was a brand new book. So I was excited to see that and pick it up. So I know this is going back a few years here, but can you tell us a little bit about how the opportunity to write this novel first came about?
Well, I've always been a fan of Doctor Who, or at least a viewer of Doctor Who. I haven't liked every single Doctor Who or every single script, but generally speaking, certainly during my children's childhood, the Saturday night, which was when it's broadcast in England, or Saturday evening, used to be set aside specifically for Doctor Who when it was on during the season. And in England, rather more than in the States, he's a sort of, if you like, a modern icon. And I don't really, that's a terrible overused phrase, but I used him in my Jerry Cornelius stories along with pantomime characters and nursery rhyme characters, characters that are well known to the British child, really. I don't know, not so well known over here, like Dick Turpin is hardly known here at all, whereas in England he was kind of a famous highwayman, you know, and sort of certainly every kid of my generation was familiar with him. So Doctor Who was just another one of these figures, a figure that you pretty much, if you were born, I suppose, in the 50s, you would have known all your life, because he started in 1964. So my children knew him, you know, since birth, and it's one of the few popular figures on TV that I would ever really want to write about, just because he has made this transformation.
One of the things that was unique about your novel, and most novelists would not be able to do this, I don't think, when they're working with a major media property, is you were able to, you know, bring your own multiverse into this work. And now, what you just said, you actually have the Doctor in some of your Cornelius stories. Could you talk about that? Because I didn't know that.
I only use him, as it were, in List as a name, you know, as one of a number of characters, say at a party or something like that.
Okay.
He just had walk-ons. I mean, if I'd have done any more, I probably would have been sued by the BBC. I think they decided this is BBC Books rather than the TV series per se. But they're the people who do most of the Doctor Who novels. They decided, I think, that they wanted to have a few, names to maybe freshen up the Doctor Who's image or whatever it is. So they got Neil Gaiman, for instance, to do an episode, I think it was an episode of. I think that came out last year of Doctor Who, and Brian Aldiss, another science fiction writer well known in England, had also done, I think, a short story. And so, and there are various other writers I know who, China Mieville, I think, who are actually all of them being approached or in the process of doing something like this. So I was really just the first person to, you know, they approached, and I was in the middle of another novel, so I didn't really want to do anything, you know. So it took a long time, and you know, they kept upping the money, which always it always makes you feel as if them feel that you're driving a hard bargain, when in fact you're not driving a bargain at all. You know, you just don't really want to do it at that point. But it was, you know, there's a strong sentimental reason for wanting to do it. So eventually, I was persuaded. I didn't take that much persuasion, and I agreed with my publisher who's publishing the other novel. You know, that I could take time off to do this, and so that's what I did. And they also said that I could, if they didn't. What was it they said? They didn't want a Doctor Who novel written by Michael Moorcock. They wanted a Michael Moorcock novel which featured Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. So this, of course, gave me a lot of leeway to include a lot of my sort of familiar notions in the book.
You describe it as a Michael Moorcock novel that just happens to feature Doctor Who, and that's exactly how I was describing it to my co-hosts on the show, and I was talking to my wife about it. Can you talk a little bit more about how Coming of the Terrifiles fits into the overall cosmology of your work?
Well, it fits with the aid of a shoehorn, I think. It's for instance, there's a character in it called Captain Cornelius. But he's not the same character, at least not evidently the same character as my Jerry Cornelius, who's pretty much a contemporary figure. Using the multiverse background, it became rather difficult because I was using black holes and dark matter in it when about halfway through the writing of the book, they began to see this other dark energy. They began to report this other dark energy that was being spotted. You know, it was coming up on that astronomers were coming up with, and so I had to work really hard to understand this other idea, and include it in the cosmology, or it would have looked a bit odd to a contemporary reader. I think I've got a couple of other walk-on parts of my characters, but mostly it was my sort of familiar, if you like, cosmology, the idea of a multiverse, which has many, many different variants of our universe, and which are actually very similar. The closer they are, I mean, that you probably could walk into the next universe and not really notice anything except that maybe the design on a box of M&Ms was slightly different. That'd be about it. So it takes a lot of traveling to get between sort of our here and now and one that's very different to what we're familiar with. And this one is really set in a future which could be our future as much as it could be anybody's future, using ideas that I've used since my first ever science fiction novel, which is where I introduced the term the multiverse, The Sundered Worlds, which was a pretty bad science fiction novel, I have to say, but bad on science and not very good on fiction. And so it was the other thing I thought is, well, you know, I wrote this when I was, whatever it was, 21, and I'd like to have another crack at it, to do it again. So in a way, the Coming of the Terrifiles is riffing off this early science fiction novel, which is called The Sundered Worlds, and I think it was published in about 65 over here. It was, as I say, not a very good novel. So I had a chance to think it over again, if you like, with knowing what I know now. But of course, I couldn't. What I did in the first novel was introduce the notion of the multiverse and introduce a hero who finally kind of gets to see the entire multiverse, as it were, without any of the barriers up. So he experiences space that is absolutely, crammed, full of stars and planets. Has, if you like, something of a almost religious experience. I mean, in a sense, I don't really write physics as much as metaphysics, and that's what I did with this too. I've got a character in there Well, I've got various characters in there who are, if you like, slightly mythical characters. There's references to English mythology as well as to English fiction, pretty much, again, as I tend to do in the Cornelius books.
Yes, there's a centaur pirate captain.
Yes, quite.
Well, and the other
problem I had actually with the stories was that I wasn't allowed to see any of the Doctor Who's because I was writing it before the new Doctor Who had been launched, and they were very paranoid about anybody, you know, revealing anything about what they were doing, so they wouldn't let me see any DVDs of the, you know, the first episodes until very, very late in the writing of the book.
Wow.
It was rather funny. You know, BBC also had some peculiar little ideas of what you couldn't do in a Doctor Who. So in one scene, I think I had these little about 6-inch high lizards in, you know, dressed in lounge suits, and they're smoking cigars, and I got a thing back eventually from Cardiff, which is where the Doctor Who series is made in Wales, and Cardiff, they all say, you know, Cardiff won't allow this, or Cardiff doesn't really like that very much, or Cardiff's going to use that, you know, so it's always Cardiff, and Cardiff was unhappy with smoking in the stories. I thought, well, you know, these are 6-inch high lizards smoking, but nonetheless, you know, wasn't allowed to have any smoking, and I think no drinking either in the story.
Wow, that is fascinating, especially since, you know, Torchwood, the Doctor Who spinoff, is based in Cardiff, and I don't remember smoking so much in Torchwood. There's certainly plenty of drinking that goes on in that show.
I think that was the other thing. I was using elements of Torchwood, which I like very much, and again, I couldn't use elements of Torchwood in the end. I think this, it's designed for an older reader or an older viewer. You know, it's thought to be the one for adults, whereas Doctor Who, although it really isn't watched by children, it's watched by children, but it's not watched exclusively by children anymore. There are probably as many adults watching it as children. Somehow they still think that that it's done for an 8-year-old who's going to be scared or influenced in some way, you know, by what you do. So that very odd feel of an adult Doctor Who, you know, the series is clearly, you know, best appreciated by adults,
mm-hmm.
They just didn't feel, you know, certain things were suitable. So really, in a sense, I'd rather have been writing Torchwood with Captain Jack, who I wasn't allowed to use either. I had to modify quite a bit in the end. Not that I was unhappy about it. I just wanted to know what the parameters were. But some of them did seem just a little bit strange.
Well, I thought it was really interesting, but what you're saying, because the relationship between the Doctor and Amy, I thought, was really spot on. And mm-hmm. you're telling me you wrote most of that, and you hadn't even seen Matt Smith and Karen Gillian, I think her name is. You hadn't even seen any of their episodes. So how?
Well, somebody slipped me a pirate or an illicit preview of the thing. So I knew about. I knew who, towards the end of the book, I had an idea, you know, who was going to be playing Doctor Who and that Amy was going to be there. So I was able to go back through it and make sort of some changes to fit it in better with those characters. But it was odd too, because, for instance, I thought, well, you know, in the TARDIS, nobody ever says where these other people, you know, where their accommodation is. Amy's a human being, so she's got to be sleeping and doing the other stuff, you know, all the other stuff. So I gave her her own suite of rooms in the TARDIS, you know, her own bathroom, her own bedroom, and so on. And I wasn't allowed to do that either. Partly, I think, because they've got some, you know, they've got a story arc, which pretty much every television series you see these days has, you know, an overall story arc. they had some plans which I think I was probably inadvertently stepping on toes over. So yeah, that was all it was. But it was a bit strange, and because little ideas I'd think of had frequently already been thought of, but they weren't going to tell me what they were because of this secrecy, and you weren't supposed to know anything that was coming, the next episode, the next series. So it was just one of those things. It was more coincidental than anything else.
Well, apparently you were allowed to put a toaster on the TARDIS because they are eating Pop-Tarts in that first scene. Even though I guess you never said they were toasted. They could have just been cold out of the package, right?
Yeah, they could have been. But I think they'd be allowed a toaster somewhere, There is a swimming pool and a library, so I'm sure they'd be...
Well, the sonic screwdriver could probably pull it off.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'd like to have had a go, see if it worked.
Well, we've been talking about some elements here that are humorous, lizards smoking cigars. The whole idea of them eating, Pop-Tarts on the TARDIS made me smile. And there's some wonderful humor in the story and wonderful humor in Doctor Who just as a general rule. I used to live in San Diego and I did some stage acting there and I did a little bit of theater of the absurd. And the hat reminded me a bit of that, this idea of these gigantic hats that weigh hundreds of pounds and you need anti-gravity devices just to wear them so they don't crush you. Could you share a little bit about your thoughts on the role that the theater of the absurd or that humor itself plays in Doctor Who? And
yes, it's one of the things, they gradually introduced it. The first Doctor Who was William Hartnell, as you know, and I didn't like him at all. He'd originally played a sergeant major in a series called The Army Game on, ordinary evening television. And it was a very popular series, and they picked him up for Doctor Who after he'd been playing it. But he still seemed to be the same little character, sort of swaggering around with a stick under his arm, barking orders at people, and he was a bit too authoritarian for my taste. Then Patrick Troughton came on and gave the character a much more fey sort of unworldly sort of angle, which I preferred. Then John Pertwee came on. I didn't like John Pertwee either because he tended to be a bit posh, and swagger about, and he was in cahoots with all the authorities. He and the authorities were pretty much one thing. Until Tom Baker, and for me, it was Tom Baker that made the series something you could. Honestly recommend to more than just children. And I thought Tom Baker, who, according to his own his own comments, did the show partly on whiskey and partly on Valium, and was ad-libbing all the time. I mean, you can see this in episodes. You could see it in episodes where once you had a recorder, you could watch it again, which your recording came in about that time. And you could see the other actors being completely flummoxed by something Tom Baker had said because it wasn't in the script, And that kind of anarchic quality, which Baker really, really pushed home, I think was what saved the series and made it something that was pretty damn good. The elements of humor which were introduced primarily with Tom Baker, and which of course the guy who did Hitchhiker's Guide, and his name's gone out,
Douglas Adams.
Doug Adams, right? He also brought that to the series, which was a big help. Knowing I could use humor was important to me, and I think if it was just a straight-faced series, I don't think I could have done it. I don't think I could do any of the other TV series that are more straight-faced. Mm-hmm. But the other thing was I'd been sick for quite a long time, or rather injured rather than, you know, physically sick, but it meant that I was going to hospitals sometimes on a daily basis. And, you know, it became almost impossible to work during that period. And so what I decided to do, since I couldn't really work, was actually go back and look at the wellsprings of what I'd been reading as a kid and sort of examine them and see if I, you know, if they still work for me. So I read a lot of science fiction that I hadn't read in, I don't know, 40 years. And I also was a great P.G. Wodehouse fan when I was a kid. I still am, but I was a really serious fan when I was a kid. And Wodehouse, of course, is known for his humor. And so I thought, well, why don't I just go back to my roots and look at the writers that I admired, you know, and who must have influenced me, must have been a strong influence on me before I started writing, and see what, or examine perhaps why, what appeal they had for me. So the hat sequence is, somebody actually mentioned this. They thought it was similar to the role of the cow creamer in one of the classic Wodehouse stories, and I've forgotten which one it was. But anyway, I mean, there's so many of them. I really did base it on a Wodehouse type of plot, with, you know, with a lot of people, rather absurdly, as you noted, chasing around after this massive hat that can only be worn by the appliance of a lot of super science, as it were. But that was what it was. It was P.G. Wodehouse, and I just thought I'd try and write, say, an Arthur C. Clarke plot, but as written by P.G. Wodehouse. And I used to know Arthur. I mean, he was a very nice guy, and actually looked a bit like Wodehouse. Both of them in old age tended to look a bit alike. Maybe we all do, you know, start to look the same. So basically, that's why the humor's there. It's an homage to or a theft of P.G. Wodehouse. If your listeners don't know who that is, he's the guy who invented Jeeves. He's best known for his invention of Jeeves, the all-wise butler who helps a rather foolish hero out of a lot of trouble. So in a way, Doctor Who has to be the Jeeves to some of the other characters who are perhaps a little bit less bright than they might otherwise be.
Is this the first novel, then, that you wrote in your, you know, post-recovery from your injuries?
Yeah, well, as I say, I started writing another one, but I was asked to do this. So, yes, it was the first one I completed. It took quite a while to get better. It was just a wound that I was having to visit the wound care clinic a lot of the time, and having sort of various minor operations, which haven't left me, permanently or evidently damaged, so it was the first since I recovered from that. But I actually didn't get rid of crutches till after I'd finished it. I think I'm still on crutches when I finished it.
More than a century ago, UEP Captain Julius Verndock helped end a galactic war with the Majesty, the first truly living machine, thanks to man-made artificial intelligence. For decades, Majesty and humanity had lived together in harmony, with mankind reaping the benefit of a world free of disease, famine, and even aging. But when Majesty decided she wanted to birth her own AI offspring, a joint interplanetary military effort fought and finally defeated her, and then eradicated all existing artificial intelligence. Or so they thought. Inspired at an early age by the works of Jack Chalker and Timothy Zahn, author A.J. Vega gives us Majesty's Offspring, a new science fiction novel bursting with action and suspense on a truly galactic scale. To learn more, visit our website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com, and click on the image for Majesty's Offspring, or visit majestiesoffspring.com. And, as of the time of this recording, Majesty's Offspring is free for both Kindle and Nook. That's right, free for a limited time. So what are you waiting for? Majesty's Offspring, new science fiction from A.J. Vega. Let's talk about the Terrafiles for a minute here. We just kind of mentioned them, the group of folks, and with the Doctor playing the butler-type character. And they provide a lot of this humor that we're discussing. They recreate human society and sporting events, but they don't quite get everything right, yeah. Which is great. What exactly inspired this idea of this group that is almost like a mini fandom or a mini, you know, medieval society that goes out into the park with swords and armor and they reenact different yeah. scenes? You know, what inspired that whole idea of the novel?
That I was more or less lifting from myself. I wrote in the 70s, I wrote a comedy series called The Dancers at the End of Time. And they're pretty much the same. The jokes, if you like, depended on a lot of the same things. You know, people getting the past wrong, and trying to recreate the past, which happens a lot in The Dancers at the End of Time. That's the whole, you know, the whole sequence of stories is about that, people getting things wrong. So it really was self-imitation, or self-inspiration, I'd rather say, than imitation, though it might be. I don't think, you know, there's nothing superficially the same except for that one sort of central comic idea of somebody, you know, somebody admiring a future which, of course, never really existed. I mean, I think also that what that came out of originally was, you know, the fact that we do it all the time. We're constantly, you know, referring nostalgically to a past that never even, you know, ever existed. Mm. And we're all saying, you know, things were a lot better in the old days. And I mean, the entire Tea Party movement is based on that notion of things having been better in the old days. When in fact, of course, things were not better; they were just different. People look back on the 60s as a great golden age, and I had a very good time in the 60s. But at the same time, we were protesting the Vietnam War, and you know, and there was the whole, you know, black movement going on. There were all sorts of things, you know, happening at that time which were not funny or nostalgic. You know, they were pretty hard on the people involved. Mm. So I think that's it, really. It's the way, you know, it's just a riff on the way we're inclined to remember the past. We leave out the bad stuff and remember only the good stuff. Yeah. So that's really what they're doing.
Yeah, we romanticize it, and that's what they do. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
I was talking with one of my co-hosts, Brent, about this novel, and he had this question that I wanted to pose to you. He was talking about it must be really difficult to write a Doctor Who novel and to write anything from the Doctor's perspective, because much of the charm of Doctor Who is we never really know what the Doctor is thinking, and his actions are a surprise to us, and his words are a surprise to us because they seem to come out of left field so often. And this could really be destroyed if we're hearing all of his thoughts and seeing everything through his eyes. And I was wondering, how did you decide to approach that? Or do you even think that's an issue when writing a Doctor Who novel?
It didn't occur to me as an issue, but I did write it, of course, through the eyes of, there's a sort of central character, or central aside from Doctor Who, called Harry. And he's, you know, his. It's a lot of it's from his point of view. Yeah. And I don't really, it didn't seem to me to be that much of a problem. I must say, I didn't even think of it, but you're quite right. I mean, it is something that must present certain problems, but I appear to have solved them. I'm afraid I can't make any claims for doing it consciously. But I think that's a very good point that you're making. But I haven't really got a very good answer for it, except that you know, I somehow came up with an idea, you know, that worked. It's probably just years and years of doing it. You know, that you do it without really thinking about it.
Right, right. And yeah, I did notice that there weren't a lot of scenes from the Doctor's perspective, and I didn't know if that was done intentionally or just because of the story, the nature of the story.
As I say, it's a very good point, and I'd like to make a more substantial claim for having known what I was doing, but I think it was just good luck. there were people on various websites and so on who thought that I'd completely messed up the Doctor. I hadn't got him right at all. I mean, there are other people thought I'd got him spot on. You know, so it's really again to do with the reader's perspective.
Well, I thought you got the Doctor down very well, and it was spectacular when I know you hadn't really seen any of the episodes, just a couple of ones that you weren't even supposed to see. Goodness. Okay, I have one last Doctor Who question for you, Mike, and then I want to talk about your other book that just came out. And we're going to create some controversy with this one, all right?
Okay.
Now, I already know part of the answer, I think, from what you said earlier, but there have been so many Doctors. I'll give you two. Who are your two favorite Doctors and why?
I think that's pretty easy. Tom Baker, who I've already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I think that was because he specifically brought humor and a sort of an anarchic quality to the character, and also the writers, you know, they expanded it considerably, and they did a lot of the really sort of good Time Lord stuff when Tom Baker was around, and I suppose the current one, I mean Matt Smith, I like him. My wife hates him, I have to say. but I rather like him. I think he's managed to, you know, to get all the good qualities. I don't mean good in good and evil, but all the best qualities that the Doctor's accumulated over the years. Hmm. Plus, give himself a very new slant on it. But I probably would have said David Tennant. I probably would have said David Tennant before that, and I probably would have said Colin, and I can't remember his name, the guy who played, you know, when they completely revived the series the first character. I liked him as well.
Chris Eccleston.
But I suppose David Tennant. I hadn't seen any Matt Smiths before that, mm-hmm. So I'm sort of talking both about the book and about the present. But I'm really, really happy with the way Matt Smith's doing it. So I'd say Matt Smith and Tom Baker.
I haven't seen season six yet, or series six, as they say in England, but over here we would say season six.
Yeah.
So I liked Matt in season five. I still give David the number one spot for what he did through two, three, and four. And I tried to ignore those specials that happened in between seasons four and five. Those are not that good.
I'm a little bit worried. You know, what happened with comics, with superheroes, was they started trying to rationalize all these different characters and put them all in the same universe. And because things weren't fitting, they then had to have other universes to put these people in and so on. And I was a bit worried that the Doctor Who was going to start going that way, where you just got too much, you know, encrustation, if you like, of stories and notions. But I think they've managed to get around that pretty well. I haven't seen many of the current series. Somebody did send them to me, but unfortunately they sent them to my place in France, which I'll be able to see when I'm next in France. And I haven't actually seen them here yet. But I do think Matt Smith's very good. I mean, and also I like him. I like it that he's, you know, apparently so much younger than any previous Doctor, mm-hmm. Which I think is a pretty good, something of a stroke of genius on the part of the writers and the producers to make him younger. It means, you know, that the whole new generation is able to identify with him rather more than if he was the kind of old professorial type that he started off as.
Right, exactly. And of course, every different iteration of the Doctor brings forth different aspects of the Doctor's personality. So by creating the youngest Doctor to date, that gives us different stuff to use, or gives the actor different stuff to use that the other Doctors didn't have access to before. Makes it a little bit easier for him to differentiate his
version
of the Doctor.
Absolutely. It's also good for me because I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk.
No, it's fine.
It's good for me because he, you know, I wear bow ties and so does he. So suddenly I'm back in style, which I've always said, if you keep your clothes and just, you know, carry on wearing them, sooner or later, you know, everything comes back into fashion. So there's never really any point in worrying about fashion, you know, because you know you'll be in fashion for at least two or three times in your life. So, you know, I liked him for that too. I liked his dress sense.
Bow ties are cool. Okay, I wanted to ask you some questions about your new nonfiction book, London, Peculiar, and Other Nonfiction. It's a collection of essays that cover a wide variety of topics, and some of the categories in there are absent friends to politics to music and more. How many years of essays are covered in this volume?
Given that there's one in the back, which I wrote when I was... 14 or 15. I published it myself in one of my own fanzines in 1956. So however long that is, I'm not quite sure how many years that is. But you know, and the there's one or two in the book which haven't actually appeared yet. An introduction or a couple of introductions to books which haven't yet been published, but which they said it was okay for me to put into the book.
Oh, cool.
Partly because I was enthusiastic about the books I was writing about. So it goes, I don't know, how long is that?
A long time.
It's getting over 60 years. there's a lot to be said for fanzines. That's one of the reasons I like the web so much. So people can do it much without needing a small fortune in in ink and paper. That's how long it is, since 1956.
When you look at the book as a whole, is there a unifying theme that ties all of these together?
Well, I don't know. To be honest, there are probably unifying enthusiasms. For instance, I was a fan of Mervyn Peake for years, or still am. So you'll find pieces on Mervyn Peake, probably that have, you know, been done over a number of years. There isn't that much about science fiction and fantasy per se, but you know, but again, some writers that I still enjoy must be in there. The unifying theme, I suppose, is just me and the people I've been keen on, and a few that I haven't been keen on, but they don't actually get much space, because I decided many years ago that if I couldn't say something nice about something, then I wouldn't say anything at all.
Mom was right. Yes.
Unless, of course, it's politics. That's where I let that one go. It'd be pretty hard to do that in politics.
Well, I don't know if you want to do this or not, but I was wondering if you wouldn't mind. Could you maybe share one of your some stories about one of the authors that you do talk about in the book? I know the absent friends category certainly has some stories of folks that you knew and had relationships with. I think there's an essay about Philip K. Dick in the book, if I remember correctly.
Yes, there is. Yes, I'm really talking about how Dick has become credited with a great deal that in a sense he didn't create. This is not to put Dick down, because I was probably the first person to write an essay on Dick as a literary writer as well as a science fiction writer in the early 60s. I promoted him a lot in New Worlds, the magazine that I ran. I was a fan, but what I've seen happen with Dick is the way he's been extracted from the genre in which he was writing. So a lot of the ideas that, say, were brought into science fiction by the likes of Frederick Pohl and the other writers for Galaxy is a primary, writers envisioning a future society rather than a technological change in society or a technological change. And so I think there's probably a slight skepticism, if you like, to what I'm saying about Dick, which is not to put Dick down at all, but is to try to put him in perspective, and also mention writers like Pohl, Alfred Bester, Robert Sheckley, who've had a huge influence on my contemporaries, and continue to have an influence. I was sort of irritated a few years ago. This is not to put Doug Adams down. I mean, he's a very nice guy, but he borrowed quite a bit from generic science fiction for his stuff, and again got praise as being the original, whereas old hands like me who've been reading it since the 50s. Knew that these were not new ideas to Doug or to Phil Dick, and I think what I'm trying to do there, and what I try to do frequently, again, you asked if there was a common theme, which this might be something of a common theme. I try to set the record straight as I understand it. You know, I'm so old, I can actually remember these things. And I say, well, I don't know actually what happened, you know. And people actually then tell me that I'm wrong, that is what happened. And that's very strange, you know, when your own direct memories, and I'm always testing my memories for make sure I'm not getting it wrong, not remembering wrong. And that's what friends are for, you can always rely on an old friend to tell you you got the wrong end of the stick, and it's not that way at all. I hope I don't feel that arrogant about it, but I do feel that certain people get left out of the record. And I think in the book you'll find a number of writers like that, not necessarily science fiction writers, but writers like Jack Trevor Story and Gerald Kirsch, who have sort of disappeared. And they were hugely influential in their day, and their books are very, very readable. But Jack Trevor Story, I don't think anybody in America would probably know, but he except that he wrote a book which Hitchcock filmed called The Trouble with Harry, which actually was a very good, very faithful transcription of the book. I was surprised, because I didn't see it for a long time. Certainly didn't see it when it came out, and Hitchcock got the kind of the comedy, the very quiet sort of comedy that was Jack's stock in trade. He got it very well. So what I'm trying to do in the book, as much as anything, is not to talk about people we all know about, but to try to talk about people that perhaps are new, or haven't been read by readers before.
Oh, well, that's awesome. You're right. If you look at any generation, the majority of writers who produce really good work, it's hard to keep them all in print. It's hard to inform writers, readers a generation or two later, hey, you should go back and read these folks, because we have so many people writing and they're producing good work. It's just impossible, and good writers
are going to
lose their work.
I think that's true. But I think again, you might as well try to set the record straight, even if people aren't actually going to read them. At least know that they existed.
Right. Well, shoot, there's another book coming out. You're too busy. And I want to get this in before, because we're about out of time here. I've had you on the phone for a long time, and don't want to take your whole evening. Well, I do, but that would be rude. Which is...
I don't think your phone bill could afford.
Yeah. Let me look at my Skype credit. No, I'm still good. A new comic, part one and part two, Elric, The Balance Lost. And volume one is just released in paperback. Volume two is forthcoming this summer. And Chris Robertson is on this with you. And what can you tell us about that and about working with Chris?
Well, it's Chris's idea. I mean, I didn't have any part in it. I had no... I didn't want to, I when I used to edit, I was the same when I, the few collaborations that I do, I've always thought it best, you know, just in this case, Chris came to me with the idea, and Boom, the comic publisher came to me with the idea, and I liked it, and I said, go ahead, you know, and once I've done that, it's the same with interviews, I'm responding to the person and trusting the person, if you like. Mm. And Chris is, you know, such a good writer in his own right. He's done, you know, he's a good comics writer, done some very good stuff. And he, you know, he lives in Austin, which is another, you know, I know him socially, but I'd had absolutely nothing to do with him while he was conceiving this and working it out. Once the series was running, I had dinner with him, and told him how much I liked it. But until then, I didn't want to interfere. I was like this when the Jerry Cornelius stories were being done as well. You know, they were done by other people as well as by me, and I never controlled what people wanted to do. Hmm. Some of them I liked better than others, you know. But I wouldn't say that, and I wouldn't. And I wouldn't try to, you know. I think I'm the opposite of a control freak, really. Once I've agreed on something with somebody, then you know it's theirs, and they should do the best they can. So I've no problem with Chris's writing at all. I think he's done a tremendous job keeping it all straight. I mean, I'm not sure I could do it. he's brought in characters of his own too, which are good. So I don't really have except that I've been enjoying the comic, and then that's the other reason for not being involved from the start. They do send me they send me the proofs of the comic, so I can go over it in case there's anything, you know, anything that I do disagree with. Mm. And I've only made one comment on the entire series, which is a very minor comment, and that was that they'd shown Jerry Cornelius drinking Pernod out of a champagne flute, which I know he would never do.
Hey, continuity matters a little.
Yes, absolutely. That's it, you know, and as I said, I don't know how it's going to end. I've no idea how it's going to end. I'm looking forward to it. I get them free, you know, every month.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. That must be so gratifying to see these characters and this universe that you created now being carried on, and a whole new audience is discovering it because of that, and you get to enjoy it as an audience member. I mean, that must be a cool experience.
Yeah, I grew up. As I said before, I grew up in popular fiction, you know, I made most of my money writing comics when I was, you know, in my teenage years and into my 20s. And there we were writing mostly about, already established characters, or you established a character and somebody else took it up, you know, that once you'd sold it to the company, it wasn't yours anymore. So I suppose I've still got a lot of that mindset where I don't actually think these characters are mine. Once I've created them, you know, they've got a life of their own.
Right.
And I feel that about Elric. People ask me why there hasn't been an Elric movie. And I say that, you know, and they say, you know, you shouldn't worry about, you know, what they make of it. The books still exist, you know, and so on. But I actually don't feel that about my characters. I feel they should be, you know, given some respect and given a chance to, you know, to create their own lives, if you like. It's a very odd feeling. So as a result, I always enjoy work with other people are doing. I do prefer if they ask me, because I've got a very fierce lawyer who if there's a, you know, actual copyright infringement, sort of steps in pretty quick. But certainly, if you know, people make up their own stories and add a new twist to a character and so on, I really enjoy that.
Very cool. Well, Mike, it's been great having you back on the podcast. We talked about a lot of things, but you have a lot going on. Is there anything else you wanted to mention that I didn't ask you?
Well, I'm starting a new series. This is the book. This is the novel that I interrupted to do the Doctor Who. Which is actually autobiographical. It's a weird thing. It's like a realistic autobiographical novel combined with a sheer, pure, you know, fantasy novel with an awful lot going on in it. So I just, in a way, I just wanted to sort of write about my own relationship with fantasy, as well as trying to tell a good, you know, good fantasy story. So that's coming out, I think, next year. It's called The Whispering Swarm, and I haven't finished it yet, so I'm assuming it'll come out next year.
what was the title again, Mike?
It's called The Whispering Swarm.
Whispering Swarm, okay.
Yeah, and it's the first of, well, as always with me, the first of three, which are really cover my entire life up to the present, I suppose, as well as, you know, add some ideas to the fantasy stuff.
Well, folks, if you want to learn more about Mike Moorcock, please visit multiverse.org. And of course, come to our website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com. Look for the show notes for this episode, and we'll have all sorts of links and books available there for you. So, Mike, it's been great having you back on the show again. Thank you so much for making
the time.
Thanks a
lot. It's been great talking to you. I always enjoy it. Thanks a lot.
Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more. And email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musicalley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.